Chapter 7. Over the next 2 days, the trio of Wraiths spent considerable time in front of that monitor, watching footage and interpreting data sent by the battery pack parasite droid, and then by droid 12 and droid 38. Droid 12 waited nearly a day in its blaster rifle before the conditions surrounding it were such that it could begin activity. When nothing larger than an insect had moved in its vicinity for a couple of hours, it ejected itself and fell to the permacrete floor of a trooper ready room, recognizable on the recording by its weapons racks, equipment lockers, and benches. On the floor, Droid 12 extruded miniature treads and crawled at a torturously slow pace to conceal itself beneath the bottom shelf of a wall-mounted weapons rack. There it waited for hours, motionless and undetected, its holocam watching ankles and feet during a trooper shift change. After an hour of stillness and darkness in the room, a tan-colored, dome-shaped floor-cleaning droid rolled into the chamber, and Droid 12 got to work. It crawled out from beneath the weapons rack and transmitted a brief command to the cleaning droid, identifying itself as a floor stain and instructing the droid to scour it up. The cleaning droid obligingly rolled over and atop Droid 12. At this point, magnets activate, clamping Droid 12 to the underside of the cleaning droid. Trey indicated the screen, which showed only Droid 12's fisheye point of view, experiencing a slight change of altitude as it rose a majestic 2 or 3 centimeters off the floor to adhere to the cleaning droid's underside. Now Droid 12 will extend leads to plug into the cleaning droid's primary communications jack. It'll begin reprogramming it soon.
Vort nodded and stretched. I'm assuming Droid 12 will detach and subvert more base droids, then find a good place to hide. All the droids it has subverted will transmit their recordings to Droid 12 at irregular intervals. Droid 12 will send all that data to us in burst transmission packets. You'll integrate and collate the data, correct?
Trey gave him a dirty look. You take all the fun out of it by knowing everything. By nightfall, they had portions of the buildings Droids 12 and 38 were in mapped and had their locations superimposed on a satellite map of Phalia Army Base. Droid 38 seemed to be locked in a high security chamber in a storage building where weapons and munitions were kept before being deployed. But Droid 12 was loose in the base's southern operations center. As the hours passed, Trey began building a three-dimensional walkthrough of that ops center, and then surrounding buildings as more and more domestic droids fell under its sway. Trey left off maneuvering a virtual point of view around the portions of the base they had mapped. He tapped to activate a persistent blinking light in the upper right-hand corner of his screen. A series of password and security queries popped up. Once he typed in a succession of correct answers, the computer opened a screen of text for him. He glanced at the others. Orders from leader. Vort and Miri looked up from their sabacc game, Vort with relief, for Miri was annihilating him. Trey ran through the message's contents.
Congratulations from Bindi on the activation of the parasite droids. She says the Wraiths on Coruscant sabotaged a turbolaser assembly line in the name of the Quadlinkers to lend even more authenticity to the name.
Miri smiled.
Nice of them. This cell, though, here on Vandor 3, we're to go into maintenance mode and just acquire data until otherwise notified. Vort and I are supposed to rendezvous with the others at Kagru Station, Cyclada Cluster. Miri, you remain in charge here.
Alone?
Vort frowned. Miri gave him a suspicious look.
What? You don't think I'm old enough?
That's not it.
Blast it. That was it. Part of the problem.
I just have a dislike of leaving a team member alone, without support. It's bad tactics.
But more than that, the thought of leaving Miri behind, of something happening to her, of having to look Wedge in the eyes afterward. Vort tried to force himself to think of her as an adult colleague, someone who'd signed on knowing all the risks of the trade. He failed.
Trey, send a reply. Ask if we can leave someone behind in addition, to back up Miri.
Trey shook his head.
No, I don't think so. If Bindi thinks she needs both of us, she needs both of us.
St- Mustang.
Besides, Miri suddenly sounded cheerful. Did you hear what Trey said? You're going to Cyclada Cluster. That's hut space. I can stay here, wallow in the mud, and eat worms all day, and I'll still be in a cleaner, nicer place than you two will.
Point taken.
Aboard the Rincon 4. Corellian Run, hyperspace route.
You know, you don't sing well.
The pilot, an Ortolan, old enough that his trunk was graying, sounded resigned. He sat in the double-wide pilot's seat, which was reinforced against his great weight, and leaned away from the navigator as though those extra centimeters might save him from a few sour notes. The navigator, a young human ensign in the blue of the Alliance Navy, smiled and replied in song, his voice cracking and off-key.
I know I don't, but the more I sing,
the more I'll suffer.
The better I get.
That remains to be proven.
The navigator smiled and stretched. Things were looser in the support and supply division of the Navy. Its personnel were almost irregulars, expected to observe all naval regulations when planetside, in uniform, or on regular Navy ships, but more like civilians the rest of the time. The bridge of this cargo vessel was spacious. The captain was tolerant, the crew was loose, and the pilot was a good sport, despite his grumbling. And the view out the forward viewports was gorgeous. The ship was now in hyperspace, somehow sideways from real space, and abstract lights that might be glimpses of stars in real space twisted and flowed past in a dazzling stream. The navigator sang again.
Coming out of the deep core, heading for my home, getting leaving Corellia, gonna put on my dance shoes, gonna find me a lady.
Gonna sing to her, at which point she will shoot you. You're making my tusks crack.
Gonna... Hey!
A light on the main control board blinked, then went out. The streams of colors outside suddenly stopped their movement, contracting into single points of light. There was no sensation of deceleration, not like in an atmospheric craft, but the navigator felt as though he should have been thrown out of his seat by the sudden departure from hyperspace. He turned to the pilot.
What the hell?
Our escorts are not on the sensor screen. What's our position?
The navigator checked his star map, did a quick calculation.
2 hours out of Corellia. Empty space.
The comm board clicked, and a woman's voice sounded over it.
Bridge, Captain, what's going on?
Captain,
the pilot reported, his voice beginning to climb in pitch.
We've had a sudden unexpected departure from hyperspace. We're showing no damage. Our escorts did not drop with us. Correction. There's one. Wait a second. That's not ours. We're being approached by a capital ship. Unknown type. It's not signaling.
Sound alert. All hands to battle stations. Send an emergency signal to the nearest naval base. I'll be right up.
The comm board clicked again. The navigator felt himself break out in a sweat. He looked at the pilot.
Should I?
Is the hyperdrive functional?
Negative.
Then handle the comm. Don't need a navigator to point away from the enemy and hit all thrusters.
As the navigator flipped through the unfamiliar maze of communication screens, he felt himself being pressed back in his seat, just a little, as the ship's inertial compensators did not quite keep up with the pilot's acceleration. Finally, he found the screen to activate the ship's hypercom on an emergency naval frequency.
This is Galactic Alliance ship Rincon 4, inbound to Corellia. We have an emergency. Please reply! Over!
The door into the bridge slid open. The captain, a middle-aged woman with posture as straight as a spear, strode in.
Situation?
Something clattered on the deck behind her. Out of the corner of his eye, the navigator saw it. A silvery ovoid some 75 centimeters long, with a small dial and a tiny screen on one side. Something in the navigator's memory whispered.
Grenade!
He acted without thinking, acted with the decisiveness and honor that others had once seen in him, that would have eventually forced him to become a fine officer. He threw himself atop the grenade. Curiously, the detonation did not lift him off the deck plates, did not hurl his burning body to one side. It didn't even really make a boom, just a pop noise. Then there was a hiss, and the navigator saw opaque white smoke flow out from underneath him, flooding the bridge. It numbed his skin where it touched him. He breathed it in before he could check himself and abruptly felt dizzy, listless. There was an impact as the captain fell atop him. He could not turn his head to see if she was face up or face down. There were footsteps on the deck plates in the corridor outside, and the navigator saw a pair of feet and lower legs. They were garbed in a civilian environment suit, something that would protect its wearer from toxic environments, like this one. The navigator's eyes closed, and he knew only blackness.